still like 45 minutes for this session?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got about 45 minutes, so we'll spend about the first 20 or so going through the board's tentative decisions from the June meeting, and the last 25 going through those decisions which the staff expect to be discussed by the board at the next meeting. So it's safe to say you have a very happy Lisa's team in front of you today, because after about 18 months of re-deliberations, we finally have a decision for you to discuss on both the lessee and the lessor side. So I'll start with that. So for those of you who have been following the project and involved in our recent outreach, you'll know, remember that the boards were looking at four different ways of subsequently measuring the right of use asset, which they dubbed approaches A, B, C and D, which I hope most of you are familiar with. So at the last board meeting, the boards decided that there were two types of leases, and that some leases would apply approach what was called A, which is similar to what was in the DP and the ED, and we've called it in this paper the interest approach. That's where you get this front-loading effect. Other leases will apply approach similar to what was approach D, which is a straight line approach, so i.e. the P&L will always result in a straight line income statement profile. However, how the boards decided to distinguish between those two types of leases was by using the thinking that was in approach C, which was called the whole asset approach or the underlying asset approach. And that approach really looked at how much of the underlying asset the lessee was consuming over the life of the lease. So using that thinking, the boards put in place a principle. So when the lessee consumes very little or an insignificant amount of the underlying asset, you'll end up with a straight line income statement, whereas when the lessee consumes more than an insignificant amount, you'd end up with this front loading effect. Now, during our outreach and feedback, many people said, just keep things simple, try and remove the judgment. So rather than leave it as a principle, what the boards did is overlay that principle with a practical expedient. And I don't know if you've got the papers to hand, but that practical expedient is in paragraph 7 on pages 2 and 3.
Wait, before
paper, the leases paper, which is agenda reference 4. And really what that practical expedient does is split leases between property and non-property, so i.e. equipment leases. So the boards are really making the assumption for you that when you have a lease of property, there's not much consumption. And as you'll see, there are a few caveats in that practical expedient. It's also important to note...
Reference 4?
It was paper 4, yes, and pages 2 and 3, paragraph 7.
Paragraph 7, and then we have A and B.
And in terms of this principle, you could almost think of it as an inverse IAS 17 line. So today the line operating versus finance is quite high. We've basically brought that bar almost down to the other end. And the boards have also decided to apply this practical expedient to lessors. So when there is consumption of the asset, you will apply the receivable and residual approach. And when there's very little consumption, you would apply something similar to operating lease accounting today. So what we really want from you in the next sort of 15, 20 minutes is your thoughts, firstly, conceptually, whether you agree with this, and also, secondly, how easy do you think this will be to implement? Do you see any sort of practical problems with implementing this?
I mean, just the way I think the boards have envisaged is we have, you know, as Jess explained, the practical experience are around the type of the underlying assets, so effectively the property gets straight-line treatment and equipment gets non-straight-line treatment with some unlesses. And what these unlesses mean effectively is that for property, we don't expect much difference in terms of determining what is today finance and operating lease. It is the way it works. So the property would get the, what Jess has said, we refer to as interest-based approach only when a very significant portion or almost substantially all of the property has been consumed during the lease, which means if it is a finance is today, but as Jess mentioned, it is inverse for the equipment. So all equipment leases will get the interest approach, in other words, the P&L method that we have under finance leases today, unless they are, you know, inverse of IS 17, as we say, unless they are for a very, very small portion of either their life or of the value of the underlying assets. So that is the kind of idea of the way we have seen this being applied in practice, but we are very interested in your thoughts and whether you think there's something that should be considered together with this to make the practical application easier.
I don't think I need to reemphasize this is a tentative decision, and this is going to go into an exposure draft, so it's not final decision in that sense of the board, but board has voted quite overwhelmingly for this method. There were only two votes against this, but 12 board members voted in favor of this method. On the IASB side and on the FASB side, it was 6-1. So six board members voted for this. And so I think, like Ada and Jess have mentioned, it will be nice to hear what are your thoughts. I know Kevin is chomping at the bits to give his views on that, but any thoughts, any what do you see as the thing would be very appreciative. So just follow the old method of just lifting your placard so that we know who wants to talk. I guess.
Sandra got up first.
Sandra got first, okay.
One of the concerns I would have is if you're leasing equipment for a shorter period of time, but it happens to be towards the end of the economic life of that asset, you could end up with triggering the more onerous accounting, and it doesn't really make sense. I think an earlier comment was, would it make sense if you are typically leasing an asset for the first 10 years and then it goes really into a different type of market towards the end of its useful life, that they would end up having the interest method applied to it where it wouldn't have been in the first part of its economic life.
Have you been talking to PK, Sandra?
I have not, but
PK, do you want to comment on this? I mean, no, I
don't want to regurgitate what I spoke at the board meeting, but my question was that should we need to think about it, because the same question that you asked, Sandra, I asked the same question at the board table. And suppose you take a building for 50 years. The economic life of the building is 50 years. And you happen to lease at the last 5 years of the economic life of the building, then the lease term is for the major part of the economic life of the underlying asset. So the question I ask the board table is that, is it remaining economic life, or is it understood as a remaining economic life? If so, then you get a different answer, irrespective of the first 5 years or last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect of it is that you should not agree.
But I don't think you should anyway, because in the last 5 years of a building, if you do the fair value of the building, 90% of the value of the building is going to be the land. Because if the building's running out of life, you're going to have to knock it down. So actually, the building itself at that point probably has a negative value, because it will cost you more to demolish it than the rent is likely.
Yeah, but the landed building are together and you cannot separate it, would you say the same thing? It's an or condition, but I'm just focusing. Just forget about the second condition. Just focus on the first condition. For some reason, the second condition is not met. I can think of 100 reasons for that. Just focus on the first reason. Then what would you do? Then you will have an inconsistent answer. So that's something we need to think about.
I think
there was a FASB board member who jumped and said, no, he doesn't think that is the way it is in the practice, but I think it is in the practice even to this day.
I think you must get the wording right. And we discussed this on an earlier phase, and I had the same question, I don't know, 3 months ago or something. And when we discussed it then, we said that it must be wrong that we say that the last 5 years give another accounting than the first 5 years. And we must find a wording which means that we are describing an asset, and you are saying if you have a small portion of that asset, independent on when that is, you get the same accounting. So I think it's up for staff to come up with a good wording around that.
I'm not necessarily disturbed by getting a different answer, because I think, going back to what Jed was saying earlier, if you are leasing a building at the early stage of its life, even if in the lease it doesn't give you options, options exist to renew. If you're at the end of the building's life, there are no options. The building will have to be knocked down. The situation is different at the end of the building's life if you are the lessee. Now, whether the accounting that we're going to get is the right answer is perhaps a separate question, but just sort of in principle, it is different, so I'm not necessarily disturbed by having different accounting.
Different accounting on the income statement, because the balance sheet is the same,
virtually the same. I'm not necessarily perturbed by seeing one business which is leasing things at the end of their useful lives showing a different P&L accounting to a business which is sort of structurally doing it at the beginning. I mean, again, we're slightly talking theoretically here because most businesses will be doing a blend of all these things. And to actually see that coming through in the P&L account, you'll lose a lot of this granularity as a user at the end of the day. So again, I would question whether it really is going to make that much difference, actually. But if you had a business which deliberately went out to lease old buildings, presumably because it was cheaper rent, then it would be doing something different to a business that deliberately went and leased new buildings.
But can I ask you, Sandra, you asked the first question in the context of equipment leases.
And
is it, how common is it to actually have a lease of an equipment, non-property asset, that is at the very end of its economic life? Like, you know, just thinking everyday situations, like nobody leases a 7-year-old car, I think, but generally 7 years is what is considered economic life of the car. So like in that scenario, I don't foresee that, but maybe it's for some other types of equipment. I'm just interested to see how common you think this is for with respect to equipment, and, you know, and then, you know, we need to think a bit more about getting the right answer.
I think if you look at our industry drill rigs, it depends on which rig is available when we want to lease it, because you only lease it for individual wells or properties. And you could have one that's available at the end of its lease term, and to have the process in place where you're going through and doing the separate analysis when typically all your leases are for a short period of its overall economic life, to have a separate process to go through and do the analysis each time you enter into the lease to determine where it is in its overall economic life. I don't think you get much benefit for that.
So you have any idea for that, Sandra, for the staff to give?
At the language, I think it's similar to what Jan said, you have to really be careful with the language. So you're evaluating it on an overall basis, you know, the original asset, and looking at the economic life compared to its original overall economic life, and looking at the fair value of the lease payments versus what it would have been when it was originally built.
But weren't a lot of those equipment leases that have this issue where you may be renting them towards the end of their life, won't they typically be a shorter lease term than the 1 year? Because this only works if it's more than a year. If it's less than a year's lease, you're going to be dropping straight into the cost-based accounting anyway with no balance sheet capitalization.
It would just depend on, you know, we have many wells that might take over a year to drill. Or we'll release it knowing we're going to do three different wells, maybe towards the end of its life.
Kevin, you?
Yeah, I think your problem is this term economic life. This is also my first meeting, but PK's known me such
a long
time.
I'm sorry, Kevin, we forgot about you. Sorry. introduce yourself.
Yeah, please.
I'm Kevin Davies. I'm the Vice President of Accounting Policy at Anglo Gold Ashanti. So, Sandra's oil and gas, and I'm mining. For us, let's take a 50-ton truck. It costs $15 million. I know the purchase price, or we choose to lease. To me, it's economic life. In my business model, is never longer than 7 years. That truck will last 20. So it's got a natural life of 20. But in my business model, it took an economic life of only 7 years, because at that point in time, the cost of refurbishing and everything else just make it non-economic in my hands, but perfectly economic in the much smaller miners who only want one or two trucks and doesn't run a fleet of 25 or 30. And so when you apply it in that business model, fine. You want to, if you want to use the whole life of the asset as the definition of an economic life, well, then I lease nothing. I'll lease everything because it's, it will give me this straight line. But because you've made already the decision not to apply the IAS 16 components, but to treat it as a whole contract, when I look at the 15-ton truck, I know that over a 7-year lease, I'll replace the engine twice, I'll replace the tires four times, and I'll replace the driver's cab probably twice, but I won't replace the chassis and the loader. So on the trucks we buy, we've split it that way on components. But on a lease, I'm going to get all the wrong accounting.
But Kevin, are you saying you think applying this guidance would lead you to have 7-year lease of a truck,
no,
applying straight line? Is that how you...
No, because I don't lease for 7 years, because I actually, most of ours, we all get in the IFRIC 4 amendment, which talks about control, as mm-hmm. opposed to the, all of the output. You've taken me out, because I get a full service provider who supplies the labor, the trucks, and everything, and I just pay him for tons mined. And if he doesn't mine any tons because his staff go on strike, he pays me a penalty. So the amendment to IFRIC 4 is taking me out on those contracts. But that's in my industry on those ones. But that's what, you've got to consider it in terms of what have you defined as the economic life, because the economic life is different. Using Sandra's example, if British Airways was to lease a 737 for 4 years, and the 737 we know has got a normal economic life, whole life, of 35 to 40 years, because that's what the cut price airlines are using, 30-year-old. You're going to have British Airways on straight line, and you're going to have Ryanair and EasyJet on capitalized and interest model. Okay. And that's the same industry.
Yeah, but Kevin, one question though. You are saying that the British Airways example, I don't know what they do, but let's use British Airways as an example. You're saying 4 years out of 30, is that insignificant for you, or is that...
It could very well be insignificant, while you define, you know, because it's going to be in the eye of the
beholder,
of the preparer. I'm going to say, you know, it's like 12% of its life, you know.
I mean, something that will solve that problem is would be using the notion of the useful life, and this is because useful life is more entity-specific, whereas economic life is more asset-specific, and we did consider that when we were preparing the board paper that discussed this, but we decided against it because, first, this could give structuring opportunities because then they can claim whatever useful life for their company, and it would also not help users in comparability, and therefore we decided to propose this more general notion of economic life, but accepting, as you say, you know, like we had, for example, EasyJet in our outreach who said, you know, we always never keep planes beyond 7 years, but we know that their useful life is 20, 30. So, you know, this is perhaps something we need to work on, but just to give you the background, we did consider that issue and thought that this maybe was a better solution overall, accepting that there are.
Yes, I think you've got to define, you know, if the economic life is tied to the business model, then in my example, British Airways gets captured because their business, let's take British Airways out, Etihad and Qatar, who keep saying we operate in planes that never last old. Our fleet is never more than 6 years old. So if they're leased for four, well, that's 75% of their policy. It's like your general comment about, well, everyone accepts that the car is 7 years. Well, no, everyone doesn't. In South Africa, the national fleet, i.e. of personal vehicles, is now running at 13 and a half years. And I guess in most of Europe, because of the economy at the moment, it's probably out at 9 and 10. So this generalization of 7 years for a vehicle is not true. If we're looking and preparing financial statements, they're going to operate in 106 jurisdictions.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin, for that. I think those are good points. Before I let others jump in, one thing I want to, we would like to get is that step back for a second and see whether this is something we would like to get your thoughts on, not just on the words in the exception, but step back to the so-called exception to see whether asset be going to be a plug number on the balance sheet, and perhaps what are the impairment implications of that? What do you guys think about that? I think I saw Jane lifting her placard first, so I'll give it to Jane first, then I will, I think it was Robert and then to Neri.
Thank you. I think it's very interesting that as soon as you started to propose two different accounting treatments, we get straight into, oh, where do you draw the line? What's the wording? It sounds nice to look through to the underlying asset, but suddenly, oh, what is the underlying asset? That's not so simple to define after all. So this is exactly the problem with having two approaches. And you also, we also had it mentioned, you'll have different companies accounting for similar transactions in different ways, comparability problem. So you're going to get structuring around the bright line, lack of comparability, and then, of course, because there's lots of subjective judgment, we're going to get lots of disclosures, you know, show us your workings, how did you arrive at that judgment, so we can check whether you've got the economic reality right. So I remain a supporter of Approach A. So does CFA UK, my committee. We think the right of use asset is the right to use an asset that will generate, and the valuation and the way you account for it is based on the cash flows, that the bundle of cash flows that you're going to create, having got access to that right.
Drop your business card with me, Jane.
And I'm not being paid by the ISB to say that. We've been consistent.
Robert?
First comment is that it's quite interesting. Kevin started talking, and then there were three users raised their placards. And, you know,
I did notice that.
We're slipping dangerously into the territory of why we're here in the first place. Any new standard that basically starts off with a conversation about where the line is, you have, no offense, guys, but you have failed to solve the problem. There is a very, and I'll open the parentheses, there's a very strong user preference for pick one of them, do not have two. There are even some users that say, you know, if you have to pick the straight line, conceptually it may be wrong, but at least it's easier for us to deal with. I'm a little sympathetic to the theoretical example that if you look at lessor versus lessee, there should be some mirroring. But to be clear, equipment leases are substantially should be viewed as capital. The only exception is a trivial lease, and 4 years on an airplane is not trivial. If you lease your airplane, really lease it for a week, maybe it's an operating lease. I think the example is a car, where if you lease it for a couple of days, it's fine. But if you rent the car for 3 weeks or for a month, and there are a lot of preparers in the room, you know what's happening. Somebody hasn't had the capital budget to buy a new car, so they've just leased it and they'll run it through the operating. Keep it simple. It's going to be the answer.
Well said. Neri?
Thank you. I'm raised the cards at the same time, but I will comment it from a different direction than Jane and Robert. Not because I disagree with their views, I just recognize that the boards are where they are now. So I take it as a baseline, and I say, you are where you are. And, you know, you can advocate them all, but you make some practical accommodation. You made some decisions, and you decided to exclude particular leases. So that's where I start as a benchmark, assuming those decisions have been made. And then pointing to the inconsistency, I just want to make some suggestion. You rejected an asset theory, an underlining theory as part of your proposal, which was appealing to me because it's also some notion of, you know, do you really pursue, do you really service it? I know it's very difficult to articulate it in a particular, but even Robert made this articulation, say, where do you draw the line? The year for an airplane, the 4 year for an airplane, or 6 years, that's a different discussion, but we all recognize that there's something that feels like a service. But we all disagree of where do we draw the line, when do we get this each that is a service versus not. But the one thing that I'm a little bit think that once you determine that this is this accommodation, I'm very sympathetic to the notion that if my business model is to lease a building and I need an office space for my personnel, I don't really care if it's the last 5 years, the first 5 years, or the middle 5 years. So think about an asset purchase or a service notion from the eyes of the beholder that will address your point as well. And maybe you can simply build into this practical accommodation associated with this.
And if the business model is not to purchase, you kick it out and you get even a more consistent outcome from a user perspective. Right? And then, you know, I know that you already have two methods. You build it, and from a user perspective, I think it represents the same thing. Because if you simply lease an airplane for 5 years, you don't really mean to own it. It's part of your service and delivery model. I would like to see consistency. So I would advocate adding another line item there that even if it's the last 5 years, but still it fits a business model of, you know, leasing or servicing type, take it out and don't think about it as the last 5 years.
Okay. Fair. I'll just go to Hiroshi, then to Malcolm, and then to Saichi. Then I think the staff has something else we want to get back to you. I think we should respect the staff's desire to get your thoughts on the other aspects. Saichi, Hiroshi.
Yeah, I welcome two models because it reflects the economic realities of risk arrangement. But regarding the dividing line, I prefer option one. I heard that some board members supported option one. The tentative agreement is a combination of option two and option three. Option two is more than insignificant portion. Option three is the nature. So I have a concern regarding option two. It's how do you define the insignificant portion? As Aida pointed out, it's a reverse image. Assuming it's a reverse image, it's like 25% of economic life. But I think it's not purchased. So I think if you adopt option one, it will be more easy to be accepted by constituencies of leases.
So when you, just for the sake of everyone, when you say option one, you're talking about IAS 17 cut that is there, right?
Yeah.
The existing IAS 17.
Yes.
Differentiation. Okay. Thanks. Malcolm. Thanks, Hiroshi.
So I have to think about whether you're making my point, but I mean, the simplest approach, I mean, you've been trying to get an answer to this subject for many years and you keep going around in circles. Why don't you keep it very simple, which would be, I think most preparers realize that perhaps we have to put leases on the balance sheet, but why don't you just put leases on the balance sheet, accept straight line approach for the expense, and let's put that in place for 5 years, and then in 5 years, see what the problems are with that approach.
So your thing is put it on the balance sheet, get everybody to
get everyone there and then straight line it, and then perhaps
it's slightly different from
I think
Hiroshi.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Similar outcome in a way, because the only thing that would be different would be in substance purchases, right?
Yeah.
And this, I mean, the boards, I don't know whether you had opportunity to follow the board discussion or read the updates. The board did these were the options that were in the papers, prepare for the meeting, and the boards did discuss it. I think it was Jan who probably mentioned a couple of times during the meeting doing something like option one IA, keeping IA 17 line would continue accounting where for 20-year lease of a plane, you would end up with having basically operating lease accounting, not recognizing the fact there is a financing in there. And we say that because previous to the board discussion, we have done this targeted outreach with over 100 companies, and a couple of them have told us explicitly, given examples of having 20-year lease of a plane, which was operating lease. So it was not something, you know, theoretical. It was a real example that the board just did not think that would reflect economics of transactions in any way. And, you know, as I said, the Malcolm, your preference is quite similar in a way, and I think the boards for similar reasons reject that, because we have heard over and over that especially in equipment leases, it is a very clearly financing transactions for those who enter into it. And not to recognize that in the sense of recognizing properly interest expense in the financial statements would just be basically ignoring the economics of that transaction. So by trying to solve one problem of people who feel when they lease something for insignificant period of the life of one asset, we would basically create a problem where we would distort economics of many other leasing transactions. So this is basically the summary of discussions and the conclusions we have had. So there was very limited support for these alternatives, even though they were presented to the board as options for going forward. Did you want to?
Saiti?
Yes, thank you. I haven't yet gathered a consensus view of the Japanese financial statement users, but as far as my rather preliminary hearing is concerned, most of them do not have too much problem in using two models. As far as all the long-term, I mean, more than 1 year leases are on the balance sheet, they think that the leases apply to quite a wide range of applications, and therefore forcing one model for all leases may not be a wise decision.
I do sort of wonder what's the point, because set out essentially, I think there were two objectives. One is to get leases on balance sheet that were off, maybe that really was the objective, I suppose, in my mind. But then we seem to be getting into this debate again and again, and you've been around and around on the income statement treatment. Like, as Peter mentioned, it's sort of, if you look at a lease in isolation, there is this sort of front-end loading problem that you're trying to solve. It generally isn't in isolation, and I just wonder if we're not trying to make too much of this issue, and that on a portfolio basis, frankly, it probably might not matter all that much. And I wonder if, I know that a lot of work has been done, but do you have sort of evidence as to just how important making this concession would be to have two models? I don't know that users will be able to make, you know, much of the difference. Is there much of a difference? And it seems like, to me, you'll have to gather lots of, companies will be gathering all the information to be, and then making all these decisions to put data into systems to sort of go that model or that model, when is it really going to make that much of a difference? Is this a really wasted effort all around in terms of distinguishing when on average we'd probably be all about, okay, I'd go with, and I could, I don't like the straight line. I think it's a bit of a fudge, isn't it? But if it doesn't make much of a difference, maybe that would be a reasonable accommodation, even if already rejected several times over.
Well said. Angelica?
We are thinking that the document needs to be clear how to identify, how to separate service contracts and a lease contract. And because sometimes it is very difficult. And I think the document needs to make clear what control means, if the company control the asset or not, in order to separate the service contract and the lease contract, because the expense will be temporary difference. But the to have the asset and the liability is different. And if we decide it's a lease contract, we put in our balance sheet, and the other part change his idea, don't have the contract, we have to write off this asset, it would be not exactly what the company is doing. I think we need to have ways to define what is contract services and leasing contract.
Thanks. Kaushik, and then to Jed, then I think the staff needs to do the presentation. Yeah, Kaushik.
I think he...
Why didn't you do it?
I quite, in my own position, and having seen these management decisions being made between operating and finance leases historically, I think it's been a lot of intellectual debate on how do you craft decision making based on how it will be treated in accounting statements. Fundamental economics remains the same, and I quite agree with Robert, to keep it simple, to ensure that we have, the whole purpose is to get it on balance sheet, and I think that's the objective. So if you're pursuing that objective, other than maybe something like 6 months or 12 months, anything else should be treated as one treatment, and that from even a preparer's point of view, and not only for preparation, but even management decision making behind it, becomes much more aligned to understand that this is what we are doing it on the underlying basis, and then see as to how the world reacts to it and how it adapts to it, because there's a whole leasing industry which has thrived purely on accounting basis, and they may have to resettle or re-understand how they would, how their business model would work going forward. But effectively, from a communication point of view, from a financial statements point of view, and even I think management decision making at the preparers level, it would be much simpler to adopt it. And something what Malcolm said, we can carve out something which is for a shorter period, which is say 6 months or 12 months, in which looks very different in context of a 6 year or a 16 year issue. But other than that, I think if we can treat it one, keep it simple and make it much more transparent, I think it would serve the cause.
Thanks. Jed, I think you're the last word on this.
I actually quite like what's been proposed. I think it's a good pragmatic solution. And I step back and, you know, the key thing I'm trying to do is compare companies that buy or lease. And I try to look through to the economic substance of what is actually going on in the transaction. And if we think about it from an equipment, or let's say we're talking about leasing a car, there are actually three components that are internalized in one lease payment. One is the interest cost that you're paying to the lessor, which is a high value at the beginning and declines over time. The second is the a cash compensation for the depreciation of the car, so declining down to the residual value. And the third component is a service-based component, because why are you leasing your car fleet? It's often because you don't want a whole department looking after the cars of your sales force, so that there's a service component as well. And one of those, the rent, and I think about the interest payment as rent, I think about the other two payments as either cash compensation for consumption. So you're either consuming a service, which is someone looking after your cars for you, or you're consuming some of the asset life. And the rental element, so the interest element, I think of as financing, and the consumption elements I think about as operating costs. And when I look at operating lease payments for businesses, whether it's vehicles or buildings, I try and disaggregate the straight line operating lease payments we've got today between those two components in order to compare buy versus, versus lease. And the dividing line that makes it difficult for us, where we're trying to compare businesses genuinely, is around this consumption issue. And it seems to me if I'm paying rent on a building, on land, or on a building that's got a very long life, like a shop on Bond Street or something that's been there for decades and decades, my view is that almost all of that payment economically is rent, i.e. is actually financial compensation to the owner of the asset just for the time value of the money that you're, because you're using the asset, because they know they've got the building into perpetuity, or the piece of land, whereas actually on the, for an equipment lease, you know, the bulk of the payment is probably OPEX. And it's that disaggregation that's important for me. And I think this is a good pragmatic, practically speaking, that actually reflects the underlying economics. You're getting the legal form that's required on the balance sheet, i.e. what are my rights and enforceable rights and obligations under the contract, put the net present value of those on the balance sheet that reflects the capital value of that the lessor has committed to you. And on the P&L, you're either getting a, which is, you know, a declining value because the value of the asset you're using is declining over time, so the interest cost of that is declining, so you've got that shape, or flatline because, broadly speaking, you've got a, for a rent of a building for 5 years, it's a small part of its useful economic life. The reality is you've almost got a fixed interest charge over the capital value of that asset for that five-year period, and that should be a flatline. And I think the net income profile gives you the right answer applying this practical expedient.
Jed, I think to some extent that's dependent on how the disclosures on the face of the income statement and things work, because I think Sue's point about if you have a portfolio, and we did modeling on our own separately, I don't know whether those things come out that clearly, but I think it's the right segue to what Jess and Ada are going to talk about, the next thing about disclosures and face of the thing. If you do straight line, it's all one line. on the income statement. If you do the amortization method, it's two lines. So I don't know how to play that. I think.
And what I'm going to do is anything that's straight lined, I'm going to assume it's all financing because you're using an insignificant part of the asset, and I'm going to capitalize that as my adjustment on the balance sheet by an appropriate interest charge. So I'm going to grow your debt. I'm going to restate debt for entities that have done that. With a fixed line, I'll gross it up, I'll divide it by 7% or whatever the number is, and I'll stick that in into the debt calculation.
I think we should try to wrap this in 20 minutes, 22 minutes maybe, because we will have 10 minutes introduction to the next thing, then we'll take a break, and 11:45 we should meet at the small groups. So whatever you do, it's we are eating into the break.
Okay, I'll be quick. So the second set of questions that we had for you, if you do have the paper, the agenda paper 4 on leasing, they're on page 5. They're quite detailed. They're all to do with the presentation and disclosure under the straight line approach. So the fact that a single line item, rent, will be given in the income statement is a given. And these questions here are what we're planning to take back to the board. So I'll just go through them maybe one by one, and if you have any thoughts, that will help us at the next board meeting. So the first...
How do you want to do it? Do you want to go through the questions first, or question by question you want to do it? How do you want to do that?
I was just going to go through question by question, but I can go through the whole lot if you...
Up to you. Yeah.
Maybe just go question by question if you have any thoughts. If not, I'll just move on to the,
okay,
to the
perfect.
Next question. So the first question is to do with how the cash payment should be represented in the cash flow statement. So under the interest-based approach, which was approach A, you'd have to split your lease payment between the payment that was interest and the payment that was for repayment of principal. So we have the decision as staff or as boards as whether we keep that or we change the disclosure. If we were to change it, we'd just put a single line item, rent paid, in the cash flow statement. Now, because the asset and the liability are already on the balance sheet, we hope that lessees still would have the information, you know, how much you've paid in interest versus how much you've paid in principal, because you have to do that. You have to do that calculation to be able to put your liability up on the balance sheet. So therefore, something that might just be easy to keep that disclosure. Whereas for others, they may feel, because you now have a straight line income statement, it makes more sense to that model just to have a single number in the cash statement, your cash paid. It is important to note those two numbers won't necessarily always be the same. So say, for example, your lease payments are uneven. You'd straight line those uneven lease payments, but obviously in your cash flow you put in the actual payment. So, you know, there may be two steps to do there. So it would be just useful if anyone has any thoughts on how they think the cash flow should be presented under a straight line income statement.
Martin?
Yeah. In practice, I think that there will always be a combination of straight line and interest approach. So the interest approach will be presented in separate. And then I don't think it's particularly valuable to have the third line just for straight line alone.
No, I guess it wouldn't be a line at all if the board decided to put it as a rent expense in operating section, because then it would be basically buried, because we know most companies apply indirect method of the cash flow, so it would be just part of, you know, reconciliations there. So what you were saying, you say do a consistent cash flow presentation as for interest approach.
Well, Kevin,
The question you're not asking, you know, is because the asset and the liability are on balance sheet, is the straight line an operating expense cash flow or a financing expense cash flow? Because I'm sort of thinking that the straight line method that is in your proposal would be an operating expense cash flow, whereas the interest method would be a financing expense cash flow. But you're not asking that question, it's position in the cash flow.
Jed just told us that it was interest.
Well, that's what I say. So that's why I'm sort of.
This question was posed by the U.S. FEI to me at a meeting about 2 weeks ago. They're very, very keen to know how this straight line operating expense, so-called operating expense, is going to be. Is it going to be interest or is it going to be operating expense?
Yeah.
Operating.
So I think I think if you've concluded, if you go down your two models, the straight line would appear to be it really is an operating type capitalized lease, and therefore it's an OPEX, whereas the interest approach would appear to be a financing type. But
interestingly, you know, under today's operating lease accounting, as you know, certain regulatory regimes require you to break out an estimated element of that total rental expense that comprises interest. So, for example, the SEC has a standard ratio of earnings to fixed charges, which is standard anytime you make an offer of a debt instrument for sale. You have to disclose this amount, and for the last 30 or 40 years, I know that this has been a requirement. So the question, I guess, would be, notwithstanding how you report it, would you still be required to disclose it in certain regimes? And I think you probably would. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there. But as I said, when we have one user who just told us that he would at least view this almost like a repo, you know, in the sense that I've got a loan for the use of something, I'm going to return it, and I'm just compensating you in the way of interest. So you're saying operating expense.
I'm relatively relaxed that you treat it as an OPEX for the rent for a shop, stick it through OPEX. I get it disclosed. And what I'm saying is when I want to do a comparison of a retailer that owns its shops versus somebody who leases their shops, I'm going to effectively strip that rent out and do a whole asset type analysis on the entity that rents. And I will therefore gross up the rent by notionally turning it into a debt and a building in order to then compare the operating profits.
So are we serving entities? You well? If you're telling us now you're going to re-engineer the accounting.
But we always will. We always will to do comparison. Doing it a straight line and putting in an operating cost won't hinder me at all from doing my analysis.
No, I agree with you, but you have to do that, whereas if you just had one model.
The only way that you don't do that right. is if you go down the whole asset model, and we're not going down a whole asset model, therefore it's not an issue.
Or if we went down approach A, I think you'd essentially get a similar outcome.
No, you wouldn't, because the whole point about approach A is that if you're only renting a building for 3 years, you'll split between interest and the amortization of the right of use asset isn't an economic reflection of the capital value of the underlying asset that you're consuming, or that you're not consuming, actually, because you're consuming an insignificant proportion of the asset's life. You get a completely different P&L profile.
I guess I'm assuming that if the lessor is essentially pricing the transaction economically sound, if it's at fair value, then it would depict a good reflection of the amount of the asset you are consuming. He's charging you for that proportion of the asset he is consuming. Otherwise,
No. So what about if you're leasing a piece of land? You're not consuming anything.
Well, then he's just charging you interest then.
Exactly. That's my point, and that's what's being straight-lined, because you're using an insignificant proportion of the asset's life. It's just interest. Now, you can call it OPEX, and I'm relaxed about corporates calling it OPEX, and we will treat it as OPEX for most businesses, because we're not having to do any restatement and not having to do comparison, but you know, you will treat it as interest when you're trying, like effectively strip the rent out like we do today, when you're trying to compare one business model where they lease and another company where they own. Because that's the difference between those two.
Yeah, I would view it somewhat differently. Even if you have an undepreciated asset, you have royalties. So the element that you think is paid a compensation for the depreciation of an asset in the context of a land or the context of, you know, some intangible asset, if leasing should have been for intangible asset, you would do the same thing. There is a financing element that simply is associated with paying things on a straight line because just generic inflation. This is simply if you think, so this is simply think in a straight line and those are around the edges. And then the question is, what do you compensate the lessor for the value of the assets itself? It could be decay or simply a right that, you know, the lessor may have. I would not view it differently. I would view rents as an undepreciated, intangible right to use something. Right, so I would treat land the same way you would treat a building. I would not make a distinction.
Just a quick comment. you know, as these people were talking about how they would appreciate it, and I think it's useful for the understanding of the user's sort of input, it depends on what you're actually doing. Jed is absolutely right that in a lot of cases it represents an interest is a good way of looking at it. But I was sort of thinking, okay, if I'm doing a credit analysis on these guys and I'm assuming a down case scenario, is this a contractual obligation? So is it a financing or is it really an operating lease? And if my volumes are down by 50%, I don't have to pay as much because I'm not using as money because I've sent that piece of equipment back. So one of the fallacies is that there's one answer that's going to fit all users at all times. In fact, depending on what the circumstances are, the same user may do different analysis.
Which is why the balance sheets reflects the legal form. What is your actual contractual obligation to pay?
Exactly.
Malcolm, then Martin, then we need to move to the next question.
I mean, coming back to the point I raised earlier about keeping it very simple, it would appear from what I'm just hearing, or even from Jed, is that as long as we get the leases on the balance sheet, and then we agree that it's not totally theoretically pure to have the straight line charge, but it seems to be a very pragmatic approach, and even certain analysts don't necessarily disagree. It seems that then if we had that very simple model, perhaps we just have to think about the disclosures, both the disclosures in the balance sheet and the income statement and the cash flow, and perhaps instead of trying to deal with it in the way that we recognize the expense in the income statement with different models, we just cover it by disclosures for these different categories. You have a breakdown of your leases by different categories, you know, whether it's a property one or it's different types of equipment. And for each of that, you sort of have a matrix to show the income statement impact and the cash flow impact of these different categories. And then we leave you, the users, because you've already heard that actually you, the users, sometimes you'll accept what's presented, but if you want to make an analysis of those companies that are acquiring against leasing, you might anyway want to do a different calculation. And then we move on. It seems you're making, you know, you've got stuck into trying to go for intellectual purity that you can't get buy-in on. Why don't you just achieve the objective, which David Tweedy clearly had, of putting claims on the balance sheet that you threw in, and then move on?
I must say what's on my mind. If you take a company and do exactly what you said, and they have a lot of leases, you may change their operating margin with 1 or possibly 2%. And then you multiply that business segment with a factor of 9 or 10 or 12 or whatever it is in the stock market. And I think you're really misleading people if they have a lot of leases, if you don't separate sort of what Jed called the interest charge and the compensation for loss of the value of the asset. There's a major impact for a lot of companies on their operating margin.
I don't think these very, very clever users around the table, I don't think you are misleading them at all. Because we've already heard they anyway take the figures and do their own calculation.
Well, at least you're misleading the non-clever majority.
You can't say that.
I think that's a question in the
last question. That's your secret.
We will reserve our comments to that in the last. That's the last question, so we'll get to that. Martin, then to Jane. I think we really need to move on. Yeah, I know it's a very emotional subject. And we all want to talk. Yeah, go ahead, Martin.
Okay. Well, I think that the proposal of the board is probably serving, giving the best picture. I fully concur with Jed and actually also with Jan on this. Yes, it will be at the cost, but I think there's also a significant cost if analysts have more difficulty comparing companies that have leases with companies that do not have leases. And I think the proposal as it is will provide a better start point than the alternative of just straight line. And to those companies that have very limited potential straight line or potential one or the other, they should be able to, based on materiality, draw a line between cost and making it completely right. I mean, that's so it's not necessarily that every company will have a huge cost burden on, based on this proposal. That's my expectation, at least.
Okay, good.
I'll just be very quick, which is I've got sympathy with being pragmatic. May not have sounded like that. And the keep it simple. But just to Malcolm, and which I've got some sympathy with where you're coming from, but as soon as, if in the notes you have the split, which is useful, between the cost, the amortising the right of use asset and the financing, the interest element, you can't then on the main statement not put the interest element, surely.
I don't think I was saying that I'd break it out. We'd have to think what the note disclosure would be, but I was saying no, it would be a one line operating expense. You'd disclose what you'd put through the income statement as operating expense. It might be a slightly, well, I guess with that approach, it would normally be the cash flow item, but that's not, I have to think that through. And then, no, it would not necessarily be the cash flow item, would it? Because you're actually straight lining a different amount. So you would actually have the difference between what's in the income statement and what's in the cash flow. You have visibility on the materiality of it, which in many businesses would not be that material. So I think you'd have enough information for you to do the reworking that you wanted to do.
I think the question two, I think we should discuss this in the context of question two also, because there is a thing. But Olivia, then I think Jed is chomping to speak. So
No.
You're fine? Okay, then to Sandra. Yeah.
Just to say that anyway, the standard will cost a lot of money because we have no systems today able to do whatever it would be decided to do.
Sandra?
Okay. I guess just a cautionary comment. Everybody's jumping to conclusion that the lease expense will show up on the balance sheet, but that's not always the case with equipment leases, especially in a capital-intensive industry where many of the leases end up being capitalized as part of property, plant, and equipment. And I think when you look at the disclosures, that's not necessarily captured. And as you're thinking about the income statement presentation, it also needs to be considered as well.
Thanks. I think to the Jess and to Ada, if we can compress, I don't think we should talk about the question C here. My suggestion to you, please.
Do you want to just jump to the last question?
Let's talk about that.
So there are some other questions there. So if any of you have read the paper and have any thoughts on those, I'll hang around in the break. The staff are interested in your thoughts. But in the essence of time, if we just skip to the last one, and the reason we put this in there, this was quite discussed in the outreach meetings. So under the straight line method, should we still require entities to disclose their interest expense, i.e. the expense on the liability that's on the balance sheet, in the notes? And the reason this was quite debated is lots of users felt that this would still be useful, and if we go under a straight line model, it's absolutely key to have this piece of information, whereas others felt, because you're now saying this is an operating cost, it makes no sense to show the interest. So staff are just interested, again, on your thoughts on whether you think we should still be disclosing the interest in the notes.
And it's linked to the liability reconciliation, which is currently required. And in order to reconcile liability from opening and beginning, you either have to have interest expense or something, you know, to arrive from the beginning to closing balance. So the boards need to confirm whether that will be.
Jerry, you want to speak?
All I was going to say was, you know, if you were doing straight line approach for everything, I'd say absolutely you need to disaggregate it, and I'd quite like to see it disaggregated between those three components that I talked about, the consumption of the underlying asset, the service element, and the rental or interest element. As soon as you've said we're not using it for any significant portion, I'm going to make the assumption that the majority of the straight line expense is a financial return to the lessor, even if you put it, and I will leave it in OPEX for many businesses, but I'll strip it out and capitalize it to do like-for-like comparisons between businesses that lease or don't lease. So I think, you know, it would be useful to potentially have some estimate of a split between that, but actually the unwind of the discount rate on the lease obligation does not reflect the true economic financing element of that straight line. So actually giving a number to me that actually isn't a useful number. So if I've rented a building for 3 years, I'm saying that almost all of that payment is actually financial compensation to the lessor. To then give me the interest component that represents the unwind of the discount rate of one of those 3 years, it's economically a meaningless number.
So your suggestion is that don't bother?
Unless you can explain to me why it's a useful number, I wouldn't bother.
Okay, good.
And is liability reconciliation useful at all for these, or you would scrap that altogether for these leases?
Just to sort of to carry on from, if you're not, the real thing that's missing in this whole thing is what is the underlying asset, not the asset, not the lease obligation that you put on the books and the lease asset you put on the books, but it's information about what this really is. And we keep talking about, in the case of a building, it is 100% interest in use right. But let's say it's a mine truck. And the thing has an economic life of, pick a number, and it's $15 million, and those are expensive trucks, by the way. A significant part of that in today's interest and rate environment is actually wear and tear on the truck. And the piece of information that I'm missing is, I'd really like to know what the wear and tear on, not the straight line depreciation, what was the wear and tear on the underlying piece of equipment would be really interesting to have. And that's why and it hasn't been mentioned here, there's a lot of sympathy among the users for the third
category.
Kind of service, yeah. And we've sort of, what's happened is we've given up on that because we've been pushed back as it's impossible to practically do.
I that's true. We got a lot of feedback because it's close to the approach C that we have proposed but there is very little support from the preparers and several users also in other parts of the world. They can't get that number. I think Neri is the first, then I'll give it to Kevin.
I think from my perspective, I think the answer is yes. The number will be useful for many reasons, but I think, if it's practical accommodation, it costs so much to generate it. And I'm going to point, we discussed the conceptual framework earlier, and I'm going to point to simply in a matter of consistency. When you deal with receivable and payables, and you have significant financing elements within receivable and payables, generally you attribute an interest portion to it. So it's useful to think about, to Jay points, the component that we used to finance and the component that can be replaced from a projection standpoint in operating costs, assuming you can make managerial decision and can alternate between the two. So I do think if the cost of procured such information is not extremely
it
will be useful to have such an estimate. And I want to suggest another point that just as an observation, many leases do have concessions where you virtually pay zero in the first few years or the first periods. And this is very, very, very common. So the question is, how do you deal with those concessions in the context of the cash flows, and what do you think about? This is another element of disclosure that you may want to consider, because it's useful to think about where you are, and when you have a master lease, it can have different issues than to Sue's points. If you do have, but many, many enterprises in conjunction with large financial institutions enter into master leases, so you tend to, the peaks and valleys that sometimes throws off the analysis. So I think those disclosures will serve to help us in doing some analysis.
I don't think the disclosure as such will be difficult, because the straight line is calculated first with interest expense, and everything else is the asset amortization portion. So whatever is the interest is the first number that goes into that number. Then the remaining is, I'll use the word, I'm not trying to be pejorative, but it's fun to put the asset number. So yeah. I don't think it's a big difficulty from my point of view, from the preparer's point of view, to disclose it. Whether it's useful, whether because it's the reflection of the economics is an entirely different argument. But Kevin and Sue?
I think then you were asking that my point that we need to move from this whole contract to the componentization is the right answer. Because in my 15 million truck where I replace the engine three times over 7 years, I'm going to give you the bad OPEX cost. because I've put in a brand new engine that's going to last 22 months. I'm going to put it as OPEX because I'm dealing with this whole contract approach, when actually I should have amortized the engine of that lease over 22 months and then recapitalized a new engine. I'm going to give you distorted numbers if I'm on this whole contract, if you're asking for what's the split between capital and repairs and maintenance.
Yeah, go ahead, Sue.
Okay. Yeah, just quickly on the point of interest, I've been doing a lot of work lately and talking to analysts that really do look at financial statements and do work in detail on issues around debt and interest. And there's a real frustration of being able to look at the interest cost and relate it to the debt and sort of apples and apples and not confuse things. So I think that's a broader aspect of needing to relate what we're looking at, we think is debt, to the interest charge. So I think probably, yes, there is a need for an interest charge, but there's a broader need to sort of clarify in terms of breaking out the components of interest or financial costs shown in the income statement, what they're attributable to. And then on the question of rolling forward balances, that is really helpful to help relate what's coming from the income statement, where various amounts are found in that income statement, what's cash, you know, where in the cash flow statement, just those simple roll forwards so we can see how information is traveling across the statements is really right. Helpful. And I know sort of lots of people are fond on lots of these things, but I certainly think if leases are material, then there should be a roll forward.
Good, thanks. Anything else you guys want to ask? Any other questions? I know we would love to engage them for some more time, but we are really hopefully short of time.
So you know how to find us, so, and we will be around. We are around here for the rest of the day, so happy to have some more chats and forums.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we will jump on to the disclosure framework as an introduction, then we will take a break, then you can have your own. Your names are assigned to these individual groups, so we can discuss that. Then I think we will have a break for lunch at 12:30. If you're done with your private groups, you can have lunch. We don't have a big space in the kitchen, so feel free to come back to the boardroom to have your lunch, although it's prohibited to have food in the boardroom, but we will make an exception because there's no space. So then we will definitely meet at 1:15 to discuss the decisions that you have taken in your individual groups regarding the disclosure framework. Two things I want to mention before I give it to Alan is that we have deliberately did not include IFRS 8 because there is a separate work stream going on the IFRS 8, so that's why the IFRS 8 footnote is not taken. Similarly, we have not done revenue. The reason behind for the revenue we have not included is that somewhere in October-November timeframe, we are going to have, I will use the word roundtable, but it's not really a roundtable, but some interaction between the users and the preparers to discuss the revenue disclosures, both in the three places in the world I think we are thinking about. So that's why we have taken out revenue. Leases, again, this is subject to a different discussion, so we did not include leases. So that's the reason. It's deliberate that we did not include those three.